Following Up is our new Without Borders podcast series, where we explore the world of media through the eyes of journalists. Join us as we deep dive into journalists' careers, uncover their daily working lives, the priorities and challenges they're facing, and how they're adapting to today's changing media landscape. Each episode, the media specialists at Taito are putting journalists in the hot seat and delving into the topics and stories that they really care about and getting the inside scoop on best practice for media relations. In today's episode, we are joined by Nij Ratanji, co-founder of The Stack, an independent tech publication and community for senior IT leaders. With more than 10 years in enterprise technology, Nij co-launched The Stack to cut through industry noise with agenda-free journalism, long-form interviews, and expert analysis, while also bringing leaders together through events, subscription, and peer communities. I am Pauline, I'm joined by Bastien. We are both directors of media here at Taito. Welcome to Following Up, Nij.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Great. Well, let's start. Please, can you maybe give us a bit of a quick overview of your background and what's your journey to running your own media production has been?
Well, where do I start? Okay, so let's go back to entrepreneurship. I think it has always come naturally to me. My first business I set up when I was about 14 after realizing my own problem when I played tennis slightly competitively. I used to keep breaking my racket strings every week and noticed that the old man who was about 75 years old that used to string the tennis rackets in my local area could only string them every 2 weeks. So I was going through rackets every 3 days, and I realized I needed to fix that problem because I didn't come from a lot of money, only had two tennis rackets. And so I bought a stringing machine, right? And to be honest with you, I still feel to this day, it taught me a lot of what I needed to know about building a business, because what you find when you're 14, no one really wants to trust you with their tennis rackets. So I had to pretend I was someone else. I'd have a really strong proposition, which was, I will give you your rackets in 24 hours. And fast forward, you know, into summers, we ended up having a very nice small business stringing tennis rackets, me and my brother. I went into uni because my parents were very vocational migrants from Africa, but Indian by heritage. As you can imagine, there was a strong emphasis on studying, reading, doing well at school. But I didn't do any of that anyway. Went to uni, ended up getting really interested in trading stocks and investing. And when I left uni, I thought I wanted to become a trader in an investment bank. Problem was, it was 2009 and there wasn't many jobs in investment banks, but I did come across an internship at Brunswick, which is quite a well-known reputation management company. And the reason why I took the internship was my mentor there was the chief of staff and actually worked in an investment bank prior. So my intention was to make him get me a job in a trading function in a bank. So I'll fast forward a little bit more. He ended up introducing me to someone. In my first week at the trading house, I got to see the star trader basically have, he had his kind of client screens there, he had his Bloomberg terminal there, and then he had his Betfair account trading horses, gambling on horses on another screen. And I thought, I don't want to be that person. So I went back into PR. And the first PR agency I went into was almost a very small, very dedicated B2B tech-focused PR agency. And it opened my eyes to this world, which was sort of weird but also wonderful. And I spent about 10 years in B2B tech, moved into fintech, always in-house, before I started feeling that entrepreneurial urge again. And shortly after 2019, when I'd kind of come to the end of the hot wire, I set up my own small agency to kind of address the problems that I felt working in an agency. And then the Stack was built from all that compounding knowledge that I spent in the tech space, where I thought, okay, there's a real opportunity in B2B tech media to make it more interesting, to make it more insightful, and to better serve the needs of senior IT buyers. And that's where it started. You know, Ed and I, my editor, we met at Golin, and we remained friends ever since we made the decision to go into business together and start the Stack.
Wow, fascinating. Yeah, I was wondering how you end up meeting Ed and then, yes, launched the Stack. And yeah, I used to play tennis as well, so I wish I had known about your business at the time because, yeah, I did break a few rackets along the way too.
Yeah.
But to go back specifically about the Stack, can you maybe say a bit more about, you know, the types of story or content that tend to resonate most with the audience, and yeah, like who exactly are you trying to target?
Yeah, so let me go back to why we created the Stack, right? Over the sort of 10 years I was in the B2B tech space, I noticed, you know, dealing with many media companies, that the role of the IT buyer, you know, the people that are in charge of making really, really big technology decisions on behalf of companies. Well, once upon a time, they were almost, think about them as like a basement dweller. You know, they weren't very loved. They weren't very, you know, seen as very strategically important. But if you fast forward to today, they are somewhat probably the most influential person in an organization, right? And just to kind of contextualize that, for your audience, the people that are part of our community, think about the CIO or the chief technology officer or the chief cybersecurity officer at a big bank. Some of those people exist within our community, and every year they have to allocate up to $20 billion, if not more, a year on IT, right? So that is the type of person that we aim to have us trust, to trust us, right? What do they need, right? They need really high signal, high quality information that they can trust that help them govern day-to-day decisions, right? So the premise of the Stack is that, right? It's to provide stories, insights, guidance, inceptions of ideas that help govern their decisions on a day-to-day. People are becoming really, really strategically important, if not the most important people within the company. How do we inform them in a way that is quick, sharp, informative, original, and in a way that no other outlet does? So that's why we built the Stack. So just going back to your point in terms of content, what resonates with them? It's not really rocket science. It's getting these stories out of people that is exceptionally hard and being able to get to the point where you can tell them. It's, you know, if I was an IT buyer, I want other information from other IT buyers. So we try as much as possible to extract those stories, whether that's by working with PR agencies to unlock those stories on behalf of your IT clients and their customers. But most of all, our work is done in-house, where we tenaciously go after some of the most closed up, difficult to reach IT leaders in the world, right? Think about the IT leaders at NATO, the US Army, the Federal Reserve Bank, these people that are, you know, these people that are in charge of infrastructure that if it blows up or if something happens to it, trillions could be affected in economic impacts, right? So that's where it started, and that's the sort of content that we produce.
Great. And how do you think the Stack differ from other trade media in the same space?
I would say we ultimately cover the buy side, right? We ultimately focus on covering other businesses. So rather than IT vendors, we don't tend to publish news on a day-to-day that is focused on product launches. We don't tend to, you know, cover all the kind of tactical stuff. So if you break down like how we're different, first and foremost is our revenue model, which actually governs more than you think. So when we created the Stack, I looked at the landscape of like, why is journalism not serving the needs of the IT buyer? And it came down to not the fact that journalists aren't telling stories. It is precisely down to the revenue model. And most media that exists today in our space, their primary revenue driver is or was pay-per-click, right? And that meant a number of things. It meant they had to take a volume-based approach to journalism because more stories, more eyeballs, more money, right? We don't do that. We made a conscious effort from the start to build a high trust platform, right? And that was really painful to do because you're not kind of monetizing up front, but over time the value of that compounds as your trust compounds with your audience. So number one is our revenue model, right? Because that governs everything that we do. That means that in terms of how we approach storytelling, it's far more internal than receptive from agencies or outside influences. It's our team's job on the editorial side to find stories. And when I mean find stories, I mean really do the hard graft in digging through Reddit, 401ks, financial reports, government reports, Reddit threads, you name it. So very little is done being received in, right? Almost the entirety of our journalism and editorial output is done completely in-house, you know? And it's funny to say, but our journalists do hard journalism, right? I'd say that is probably a differentiator to us today, but it all stems from the fact that our revenue model is fundamentally different because our team are not pressured by the fact they have to publish so many stories a day because that will have a direct impact to how we make money.
Could you describe your revenue model a little bit in more detail? And I'm also curious if this was the same from the start or how it or did it evolve over time?
Yeah, so revenue model was the same from the start. I think both Ed and I, when we looked at the media landscape, we just knew that this model of pay-per-click was going to die or was really fragile for various reasons, right? Various reasons. So we made that hard decision. And during the early years, was so difficult not to say, right, let's just turn it on. You know, we're getting traffic through, let's just turn it on. We need money, right? Because like every other journalist platform, editorial platform at the time, you're struggling. It's really hard. But we had a really strong conviction, and my personal conviction on the industry was that high signal, high trust, high authority, building community, that will never die. And when you get into niche, high-value audiences, like we are in a very, very niche, high-value audience space, right? And if I think about our customers, and people that effectively need to come through us because we are a really high authority platform to this community, that's where we wanted to play. Not necessarily a gatekeeper, but a point of authority. But building that authority takes time. And you can only do that if you really are prepared to put so much energy up front to create high quality content, be tenacious in securing those interviews, being able to publish content that matters, but is promoted and you grow organically rather than is paid. So it hasn't changed over time. The downside of that model is it's taken time to get to that space, right? The positive of that model is it's a snowball. The value of that has compounded over time. From the point of view, now people know about us. We are trusted amongst that IT leadership audience. And as a result, that snowball of trust and commerciality, because IT vendors and IT companies see us as a point of authority to get in front of these communities, we are increasing our, let's say, land mass in that space. So in terms of commercial products, again, there's a balance here we need to strike because we don't want to upset or jeopardize the value of our primary audience. So we needed to think about that. The second thing is, We needed to think about what would help us create integrity, but also balance the needs of an IT vendor or an IT company that wanted to get in front of these people. The third thing is we wanted to understand how do IT leaders buy, right? And you wouldn't believe how many conversations I have with PR agencies, marketing agencies, CMOs in multi-billion dollar IT companies that still don't fundamentally understand the two most important ways that people with IT budget buy. And that is through peers and that's through third-party trust. That's what starts those conversations. So if we look at the other media landscapes, and actually going back to your earlier point of how we differentiate, we don't have 1,000 different products because we're not selling pairs of trainers. We don't need tons of banner ads. We don't need to do, you know, programmatic advertising. We don't do lead gen because it doesn't matter or serve the needs of our primary audience and it doesn't impact them. So if it doesn't impact them, why should we sell it? Right? So there's only two things we do at this stage, right? And obviously that would expand over time. That's really helping IT companies tell stories that cut through to this audience in a really compelling way, both with on our platform and within their respective businesses, because we can be external and because we are, we have a slight bit more clout than unfortunately marketing functions do. We're able to really stress test and go in with our expertise. And secondarily, we find organic ways to create physical platforms for IT vendor executives to connect with these people. So small scale dining clubs. We are, as you may know, we are doing our first ever conference in June. I say conference, but it's in true Stack style. There's 100 people there, very closed door, very, very exclusive. Yeah, so I mean, fundamentally, there's a very small amount of ways that you can connect with IT buyers. And I'd like to think that gives us that sharpness and focus on both sides. We're going to genuinely meet the needs of you guys on a commercial perspective in terms of connecting. But also, we're doing it in a way that doesn't compromise the needs of our primary audience, the IT buyer. We're doing it in a way that actually supports them. Because it's not like they don't want to hear from IT vendors. They absolutely do. But they want to do it in a way that's concise, precise, in a trusted way, right?
Have you ever experimented with paywalls, with subscriptions for your readers?
Yeah, so we have a very crude beta test at the moment.
You do right now.
Of a paywalled product, which is basically accessing our premium content. I say it's less of a, at this stage, it will be built out into something more sophisticated. But at this stage, it's a very low-level product where you can access our premium interviews, you know, sort of the stuff that Forrester and Gartner charge $2,000 a piece to read. It's an annual membership, £250 per seat, gives you access to not only that content, but gives you access to our community as well, which is more important. Still in its early stages, you know, we prefer to just launch and test and iterate and see if there's demand and interest. We're still at that stage where we're bootstrapped and scrappy. But it will evolve over time because fundamentally the prize of our business is the community and actually being able to do as much as we can with various segments or broad segments of our community is something that we will really be doubling down on as we evolve.
I see. What is super interesting about you is that you worked on both sides of the fence, so that you started working off in PR and then launched your own technology media publication. And I'm wondering if there's anything that the media world has taught you that you wish you would have knew when you have been still a PR.
Oh, it is so effing hard to be a journalist. That is probably the first point of realization, right? To be a proper journalist, it is really, really hard. And I think, you know, if you're in a PR agency, you know, everything's really nice. You know, you've got a nice setup. You've got your MacBook. You've got coffee on tap. You've got a drinks cart running around. Meanwhile, this journalist is fending for their life and their inbox and, you know, potentially their job more broadly. And actually just having an awareness of that really changes how I would approach journalists moving forward, right? We have it slightly easier because most of our inboxes get deleted, you know, and it's a real stress relief for our teams. But I would say that is probably the number one thing. And the reason that I know that is because on the odd occasion Ed steps away, he forwards me, he redirects his inbox to mine, and it is absolutely relentless. Now, if you think we've actually got a team, and fortunately Ed's got some operational support and we have other team support now as well. But if you think about it in the context of an editor, their job is not just to write, but their job is to review, be accountable to their operation side of their business, do other administrative tasks, and then they're expected to write stories. It's hard. So that's one way, I would say.
Yeah, I can totally understand. I think like being able to focus on one thing and ignore the rest is a key skill journalists need to have, right?
Yeah.
If you... like I understood that you almost ignore all PR, but if there is like, what are the ingredients to still make the cut and catch the interest of you guys as a PR person? Is there something that stands out? Perhaps do you even have like a good example?
Oh my God. You know, I think number one, we're not almost exclusively, but it do PR. It's called public relations. And I think one of the things that really frustrated me most about running a function in an agency was just the reluctance of people to pick up a phone, and speak to someone or take someone out for lunch, right? How do you expect that someone is going to respond to you if you just bang out emails to them? There's no rapport there, and rightfully so. You don't deserve a response. What makes you think you deserve one? And I think, being perfectly honest, is that sense of entitlement where the industry, and it's through no fault, is systemic, I feel, because you're not taught to feel this way. When you come into an agency, it's like, okay, you've got a spreadsheet of contacts here. Let's just mail out stuff, right? It's not broken down into a quality or a quality approach. Who are the five people you need to target? How can you build meaningful relationships with them, right? What do they need, right? Deliver value, like anything. Build rapport is what that sort of summarizes, I guess. I say the other thing is it pays to pay. This world of earned media is, again, it's quite an entitled approach. But actually, I think a lot of people that come into agencies don't really realize how symbiotic the industries are between one another, right? You need to work with one another. Think about, okay, how can I actually deliver value on the earned side? But how can that also translate into something where it's meaningful for the commercial aspect of that editorial business? That's definitely going to get the attention of our teams, right? And so many of our most productive relationships come from that blended approach these days, because there are fundamentally things that agencies can't do that we can do, and vice versa. We're not here to take people's jobs. We're here collectively to try and do something meaningful together. So it pays to pay. That's another thing.
Yeah, I totally believe in we being a service provider for our customers, but also for journalists. And that's exactly what you're just saying.
Yeah, and actually, that's a really good point. I think so few people realize that the secondary and arguably the most important stakeholder is the media, because your clients will leave you. Your clients will try and make you abuse the media. They'll say, send this flipping press release out. And so many times they've been like, when I was growing up, certainly, just do this. Why? Why am I going to jeopardize my media relationships? They're my primary stakeholder. That client's going to piss off. My media relationships are not. So I think it's really, really understanding the long-term impact of whether you do good PR or bad PR. And it does come down to that.
Yeah, great words. Perhaps before we move into... there was our question. Can you tell us a bit more about the conference that you're organizing in June?
Yes. So it's in April. So April 16th is our first ever conference format that we're rolling out. So it's specifically focused in financial services and regulated industries. It's an afternoon in New York. We've got some of the biggest C-level IT people as panels in the conference. It's in typical Stack style. So it's, rather than going big, we're taking a quality and a heavily curated approach. There's only 100 seats up for sale, and they're only available to practitioners. Sponsors can get in the room, but again, in a very, very select way. We're managing that quite heavily. We'd rather not have any sponsors than have sponsors. So we've got two sponsors there. And then, tickets are paid for on the premium end. All the conversations at the conference are going to be focused on practitioners. What are they doing? And the people in the room are going to be hearing exclusively from some of the biggest IT leaders in the world in that industry. So think about the CIO of JP Morgan, the CIO of Nomura, the CISO at a big insurance company, Assurance Re. So it's, again, in our style, maintaining the quality, really demonstrating the quality of our community, because that's quite hard to visualize and kind of put into perspective. But I think it's another really interesting point about how media is being measured, which I know is something that isn't necessarily being covered off here. But in terms of how we present KPIs commercially, it's gone away from impressions, because they don't fundamentally matter. who are you reaching is really, really important. And this event format is a real, like, look at the people that are in our community base, right? And that's why I wanted to do it.
Interesting. And you also, the Stack also run a successful newsletter alongside the online publication. So perhaps can you tell us a bit more about the newsletter specifically, but also, you know, more generally, we are seeing, you know, alternative media formats being developed. So newsletters, podcasts, also on social platforms. And it really seems that there is a bit of a tipping point where these channels often match or even outperform traditional outlets in terms of reach and engagement. So, you know, from your perspective, what is driving this shift?
I take quite a different stance to this because I think, you know, people think about media formats, but I think about products, right? When you're building products. And we, you know, you'll look at the Stack right now and it's a, you know, semi-static product, but we are having these conversations internally about how the Stack is changing and how it evolves. And that a large part of that is building different editorial products. So like any product, when you're building a product, you've got to think about the heart of the audience. And what you don't realize within even our weird world of B2B tech is there's different audiences within that industry, right? When I'm saying there's going to be people that are interested in or whose job it is to do cybersecurity, there's going to be people that are engineers, developers, people that are AI specialists. So we're looking at the landscape and we're thinking, right, what products fit these landscapes? And then the channel is the means, right? So it doesn't really matter. We're looking at potentially engineers. How do they best feel communicated to? Is it a newsletter? Is it going to be a podcast? Is it going to be more in person, something a bit more experiential? So that's how we're thinking about them, right? And I guess right now, Stack version 1.0 is quite static in the sense of, right, we've got that initial inception of the audience base, but more and more our approach is, okay, how do we build products that suit the needs of specific sub audiences, and what does that look like? So you'll see in time, and what's coming up as a little teaser is, you know, what that looks like. Are we building podcasts focused on engineers? Thinking about it slightly abstractly, like, why don't we just make an engineer do the podcast for other engineers that's really well respected? That isn't part of our editorial team. Why don't we brand it in a slightly quirkier way that isn't necessarily part of the typical Stack brand? Why isn't the tone of voice separate from the Stack brand? Because it needs to appeal fundamentally to those subsegments of our audience. So that's how I'm thinking about it. Now you'll probably get an email from Ed saying, "No, you're all wrong. You know, take it back." But I think fundamentally that's the approach that I feel is best to take.
Well, a lot of exciting plans. And, you know, maybe the elephant in the room is the impact of AI and, you know, how AI might impact the traffic going to the Stack. So we were wondering, like, how you're navigating this shift and, you know, what are your concerns marginally with AI tools?
Yes. So we're not concerned about AI tools precisely because of what I said earlier. It comes down to the commercial base. We're not scared of AI taking our content and contextualizing it. In fact, we're totally optimizing for that. We're not so focused on clicks coming to our website, for example. It's an important thing, but we recognize the fact that consumption of our insight is going to happen in very different ways, right? And that's why we've over-indexed for it. And we are noticing it right across the board, both on our content, because of the format of journalism we do take, i.e. kind of slower, high signal, trusted, more evidence-based, longer form stuff. AI is picking up on that, right? Because they're picking up on the fact, like, hey, the Stack is really credible in this space. And we're ranking really highly. We're being indexed in AI because it's calling us. All the LLMs are using us, and there's so much evidence of that. On two sides. So we're seeing both our prospective clients come to us because when they type in, what do IT leaders consume for their insight? The Stack shows up. And also on our clients' behalf, when they work with us on the commercial perspective, they recognize that their content or their information from being on the stack is ranking as well. So we're embracing it, right? And we, you know, I'm not going to pretend like we are experts. We are actively, you know, joining beta programs with places like Reddit and facilitating, you know, more optimization, generous optimization with our content. But we are, you know, we're definitely embracing it.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, super interesting perspective that I haven't heard before. So basically, AI is just another channel for you where people consume your content, and this makes the stack even more relevant for IT suppliers, for example, right?
Yeah, and again, like I always ask the question, and I think this is something that PR people and bosses of PR agencies should encourage the new people coming into agencies. It's like, number one, like, why the hell are you doing this? And number two, why, how do IT buyers buy technology, right? How do they discover and buy technology? And one of the ways they discover it more and more now is by searching on platforms. Why are they doing that? They're doing that because they don't have time to consume Forrester reports or Gartner reports. Instead, the future is searching and getting context back on these platforms. And more, these platforms are going to be crawling the highest trust platforms. And we're going to be there. We will always be there because we've got kind of got that head start in that. And we'll plan to double down on it. So we're embracing it. And I think ultimately you kind of have to roll with the punches, right?
Very interesting. Apart from AI, media consumption is also shifting, like the habits of media consumption. So we see the rise of newsletters, of course, podcasts, but also short form video content. And we are wondering, how do you see this affecting the media industry over the next few years?
I'm a big fan of paid newsletters. And the reason why is because if you're very focused on achieving something, I think this goes back to like the way I consume knowledge. I think there's so much content you are bombarded with, like, you know, every day you are bombarded with different content, and you've got two choices. You either have the algorithm determine what you consume, or you determine what you consume. So the way I consume content, and the way my peers that build businesses or are in the space consume content, is they heavily curate the consumption of their own content, right? So I think that certainly within industries, when you're looking to consume content, you're going to find the most effective platforms that help you understand what you need to understand as easily as possible, right? So I don't really have a stance on, you know, whether it's a newsletter or whether it's a podcast. I think obviously going back to the point on GPT, people are inherently lazy. Smart people, I found, are even more inherently lazy because they want to try and find the most efficient way of getting a really productive outcome. You know, I love long-form content, but at the same time, it's an indulgence. And sometimes when you need to really quickly understand something, or where you need to really take time understanding something, there needs to be different mediums for them all. So it depends on what you need, right? And I have no stance on which one will survive, which one, but ultimately I think all are great, but for different reasons, but that's just my stance.
Yeah, can totally understand. Thank you. We are coming to an end of this episode, and we always end the episode with the same questions. And we also want to ask those you, of course, and the answer might be AI, but we also heard very exciting different answers. So I'm looking forward to what you think. So the questions are, what's been the biggest change in how you do your job since you started out? And what do you think will be the biggest change over the next 10 years?
There's a number of lenses there because, you know, number one, there's a sort of startup entrepreneur lens. And number two, it's the actual industry focus lens, right? We're growing, right? And I think the entrepreneur in me is, Ed and I both, the benefit of being a bootstrap company, is the fact that you can like literally move at, rocket pace and just make a decision. We started the stack actually. When we started the stack, the way we started it was during the pandemic, and it was probably the most intense feeling of responsibility that I felt when Ed and I spoke about this idea of the stack and said, right, I think we should do this. I have a real strong conviction in this space because of this reason. And the third Zoom call we got on, Ed just said to me, right, I've quit my job. Let's get going. And, I've told my wife and my three kids, and I'm like, all right, maybe we should have done that slightly the other way around, but, we did it. So if you fast forward to today, we're actually a company. We have journalists. We're thinking about product. We're thinking about strategy. We're thinking about all of the things that you have to do as a grown-up within a business, particularly one that where you're looking to scale. So once upon a time, it was really tactical. Let's put the planes on, let's put the wheels on the plane and just try and make sure that it can hit the runway with some wheels on it, right? Now we're thinking about how do we scale effectively? How do we offer more sophisticated editorial? How do we double down on our mission? Is it still sustainable? All of those kinds of questions. So as I'd mentioned earlier, we have quite a nice balance between Ed and myself, where he can still be that really fast-moving engine, and I can support on those slightly bigger initiatives where we take them on together. And when the proverbial shit hits the wall, what's going to stick, right? So that's one lens. The other lens was in terms of like how I see the change in the editorial landscape. And it goes back to the point that I made slightly above, where I'm thinking about we ultimately will scale as a platform. And that means, yeah, more high quality content, but it won't all look the same, right? I think one of the things that the industry is guilty of is not exploring the niches within the niches. And that's the most exciting stuff for us. So we have a weird and wonderful world in B2B tech of different people. We notice that engineers, for example, are like really quirky, like they've got multiple interests. How do we build something that matches their needs? How do we brand something that matches their needs? What sort of format do we consider? So I say that is editorially the changes that we're thinking about, right? And I feel like the future of the stack will almost feel like an umbrella brand, which consists of different components, editorially aligned with various audiences that then has a top layer that serves that original need, which is the senior IT buyer. So those are the two things. Hopefully that's useful.
That was great. Thank you so much, Nish, for giving us an insight into your world. It was great to hear your views from your experience working in PR, but also from your entrepreneurial experience running the stack. So yeah, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Following Up is a Without Borders podcast series produced by pan-European B2B tech PR and communications agency, Taito. You can find every interview on YouTube and all major podcast platforms. Subscribe now so you never miss an episode.